Live from the Business Radio X studio inside Renaissance Bank, the bank that specializes in understanding you. It's time for North Fulton Business Radio.
And hello again, everyone. Welcome to another edition of North Fulton Business Radio. I'm John Ray. Yes, believe it or not, I'm John Ray. I've got a little frog in my throat, getting over a little cold, but bear with me, and we're going to get to a great guest here, and we're going to let him do the talking. But we are coming to you from the Business Radio X studio inside Renaissance Bank in Alpharetta. Folks, today you're more connected than ever, and whether it's your friends, your family, or your life, Renaissance understands how you bank, offering the mobile banking services that you need. Renaissance also knows that sometimes you need to speak to real people with real answers, and that's why Renaissance has more than 190 convenient locations throughout the South ready to serve you. For more information, go to renaissancebank.com. Renaissance Bank, understanding you, member FDIC. And now we turn to Jesse Morton. Jesse is the Director of Dispute Consulting with Stout. Jesse, welcome.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So tell us a little bit about you. Tell us what Stout is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Jesse Morton. As you mentioned, I'm a director with the global consulting firm of Stout. Stout as a firm has about 500 people in 17 offices in the U.S., 6 overseas, 4 in Europe, 3 in Asia. And we really specialize in 4 different things. In order of size, we do valuation, which is basically anything that puts needs a number put on it. We help value it and put a number on it. We have a dispute consulting and forensic accounting practice, of which I'm a member. And we help with preventing, detecting, and responding to fraud and fraud-related issues. We have an investment banking practice, which specializes primarily in sell-side investment banking of transactions of any size, from $5 million up to several billion dollars. And then we have a management consulting practice.
So you really work on the high-end kind of accounting and advisory work. I mean, you're really doing some pretty involved projects.
We are, although one of the things that we pride ourselves on is that we take projects of all size. No project is too small, and really no project is too big. So we work with a lot of individuals, and we will take cases that are a couple thousand dollars, helping individuals with stuff like tax-related issues, intellectual property-related issues, divorce cases. And then we have a lot of clients that are the ones that you hear about and pass on a day-to-day basis, a lot of the Fortune 500 companies.
Jesse, you've got quite a background you bring to this to the work you do today. Tell us a little bit about you personally.
Yeah. So I am a CPA. I'm also an attorney and a certified fraud examiner. So you don't want to commit any wrongdoing around me, I guess. or if you do, you want to make sure you cover it up really, really well. Yeah. But the type of work that I specialize in, I really have 2 specializations. One is just generally helping individuals and businesses with preventing and detecting fraud. And by fraud, it can be really any type. It can be asset misappropriation, like, for example, a physical theft or embezzlement. It can be financial statement fraud, where people are cooking the books, as they like to say. Or it can be regulatory-related issues related to anti-money laundering, bribery, corruption, and some specific banking and healthcare-related regulations.
Now, Jesse, fraud is one of those issues that people look at and they say, you know, that happens to other people, but not to me, right?
I've heard that a lot.
I bet you have. Dive into that. There's a lot of different aspects of fraud. Maybe talk a little bit about the kind of fraud work you specifically do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned that I do help a lot of smaller businesses. A couple recent examples of projects and cases that I've worked on. One of them local here to Atlanta, where me and my firm helped a professional services firm, mid-size. They had about 10, 15 employees, so a couple $1 million in revenue. They had a office manager that had worked for them for a couple years, was in their mind a phenomenal office manager, kind of did everything that they had hoped and wanted, developed trust with the business owner. And lo and behold, they discovered after about 2.5 years of her working with the business that she had systematically embezzled about $250,000 from the business. And because of the level of control that she had in her position as office manager, and because of the trust that she had developed, excuse me, where they had continued to give her more and more responsibilities and oversight, the fraud was able to go undetected for 2.5 years. And what we were able to do was review business records, conduct investigations, and through a variety of other means and methods, put together a case that we were able to turn over to law enforcement.
So Jesse, talk a little bit about maybe you could start by talking about what the signs that a business owner ought to be looking for that might indicate that there's a problem. And, you know, by the way, one of the things I've heard is that there's no more dangerous person in a company sometimes than the trusted bookkeeper, you know, because sometimes absolutely. That trust can get invested too deeply.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the times there aren't any signs, and that's part of the problem is that very frequently the individuals that are committing fraud are very good. Yeah. And as they're committing frauds, they're honing and changing their methods to make sure that their tracks are being covered. So unfortunately, a lot of times there are not a whole lot of what we call red flags or indications that something's wrong. What I would recommend, though, is that any business owner, there are very simple things that the business owner or managers can do that take no more than a couple minutes a week or a couple hours a month to really help prevent and detect fraud from occurring. And those are things, some of which might sound really obvious. I mean, one of them is physical security, making sure that cash that's in the office is locked up. It's making sure that you have the right passwords. It's making sure that check stock is locked up. Performing reconciliations, bank statement reconciliations, and comparing the accounting records to the bank statements to make sure that everything is consistent and makes sense. And generally having a system of segregation of duties in place and making sure that no one individual has too much control over certain processes. And really the concept of segregation of duties, it's not just to prevent fraud, it's to prevent errors. We're all human.
Sure.
And there's really no reason for a business not to have just a basic level of separation of responsibilities. So for example, one example of segregation of duties would be the person who's generating checks to pay invoices as part of accounts payable should not be the individual that is signing the checks. There should be another individual that's reviewing the invoice, signing the check, and there you go. You've effectively prevented one individual from being able to generate a check, sign a check, and then send it out. There should always be some sort of supervisory review. And just generally, and I think this goes for businesses of all types, whether it's a small business of 2 to 3 individuals or a Fortune 500 company, is that the tone at the top really is going to set the tone for what people believe they can do and what people believe they can get away with. And when the owners of a business really stress the importance to employees of doing the right thing and make sure that they instill in their employees that if they see something wrong or they suspect something wrong, that they should blow the whistle. And then where there are issues that are identified, whether it's fraud or something minor, there does need to be discipline. There should be, I'm not talking about corporal punishment here, but there, you know, if someone's violating the rules, the tone does need to be set that that's not going to be tolerated.
Right.
So that if and when there's a bigger issue like a theft or embezzlement, that employee knows that it's going, that the managers and owners are not going to tolerate it and they will be called out on those things.
And again, this is where I think business owners look and say it's somebody else, because they say, hey, you know, my trusted controller, Wanda or Jack or whoever, you know, has been with me for years. You don't understand, you know, she's almost part of the family or he's almost part of the family. Right. You know, that's something I'm sure you run into all the time.
Absolutely. I think that is probably the most common statement that I get when an individual discovers that something's wrong. And again, that's even in huge organization, Fortune 500 organizations. I'm going back about a dozen years ago, but I worked an interesting case for a very large global nonprofit organization. Now, my own take is that if someone's going to embezzle money from a nonprofit organization, I mean, it takes a real special kind of scumbag to do that. But especially this from nonprofit that was out there really helping people. But I remember my first interaction with the chief financial officer that discovered the fraud that was occurring in her group by a very senior accounting officer. It destroyed her. She lost trust in almost every aspect of her life. She couldn't believe that it happened to her, and she felt extremely personally responsible. And the human aspect of fraud, I mean, is undeniable. It impacts people not only financially but emotionally and mentally as well.
Sure. Folks, we're speaking with Jesse Morton. Jesse is director of dispute consulting with Stout here in Atlanta. Now, Jesse, let's get into what happens. What should I do if I find out that or I suspect that there's fraud going on? First of all, call you, right?
Call me. Okay. That's the easy one.
Yeah.
What I would recommend is at least performing a very preliminary review. And what I mean by that is, especially for small businesses, there's not much that can occur most of the time without things spreading around the office like wildfire. So you don't want to raise alarms, and you certainly don't want to make accusations that are unsubstantiated. But I do think, again, there are certain little things that you can do. And business owners can, again, look at bank statements. They can call their bank. They can ask whether there's been any sort of unusual activity, whether there's been any changes on the accounts. They can do these reconciliations. They can review their financial records. And if a small business has a regular CPA, whether it's internal or external, assuming, of course, the CPA is not suspected and being involved, that's probably a good first step, just to kind of take a pulse as to whether there may be kind of meat on that bone. But typically that should lead to engaging an independent third party to conduct a more thorough investigation to see whether the allegations are substantiated, and hopefully put together a case file that will provide some complete or near complete information about what happened, how it happened, why it happened, who committed it, and perhaps most importantly, what can be done to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned something there that's really important, because there's a employment law issue here too. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you are going to accuse somebody of fraud, you better have your facts straight, right?
Absolutely. And I certainly would not recommend in any way going in guns blazing, even if you got a case file, even if you've got 100% certainty that someone's committing fraud. You know, definitely don't go in there guns blazing and yelling and screaming and firing the person and right. taking certain actions without seeking advice of counsel, an employment lawyer, because there is a right way to do something. There's a wrong way to do something. And sometimes where there is fraud suspected, sometimes, as counterintuitive as it may sound, you actually want that fraud to maybe continue a little bit longer once you've engaged somebody so they can actually see it happen firsthand. Or if you're going to take the law enforcement route and contact law enforcement, and that is the goal, is getting the person convicted or arrested, there are opportunities to literally catch a person red-handed. So when something's suspected, there certainly is a long and kind of calculated process to going about it in the right way.
Let's one more question on fraud, then I want to move on to some of the other aspects of your practice. I guess in terms of prevention, you mentioned some of the, I guess, processes that, mm-hmm. that you ought to have in your business, but talk a little bit about the, maybe the hiring process, you know, before you bring that person in, because, you know, I've heard, once someone that proves themselves to be a fraud, they're always a fraud. I mean, what's your take on that?
I would agree with that for the most part. There are exceptions. But you know, I think it's a great question because one of the things that I think a lot of business owners, small and large, fail to do is do appropriate background checks on individuals before they even extend them a job offer and bring them on board. And then conducting background checks or some kind of review and update on the individual's habits to see whether there may be something concerning that's come up since the employee's been hired. The Association of Certified Fraud Examiners puts out a annual report that surveys thousands of victims of fraud, victims meaning companies and individuals who've been the victim of fraud. And they put together some really interesting information about what the typical fraudster looks like. And I think in many ways, what's interesting about that report is that the fraudsters are not necessarily who you would expect. Most of the time, the fraudsters are individuals who have not been convicted and don't have a track record of committing fraud in the past. Now, when you kind of dig into that a little bit, it's a little bit misleading because just because somebody hasn't been caught committing fraud or hasn't been charged with committing fraud doesn't mean they haven't done it before. A lot of times what happens, and in the case that I mentioned earlier, the individual highly likely did commit fraud before, the office manager did commit fraud before, but a lot of times the businesses that end up terminating individuals because of embezzlement or breaking the law, they're quite frankly just embarrassed to admit that they're a victim.
Sure.
And so they don't really want to put it out there.
Right.
And not only that, but going back to the legal implications, if you have an employee that you either strongly suspect has committed fraud or you know has committed fraud and they're terminated for those reasons, and for one reason or another, you decide not to pursue law enforcement or some other action, and then you get a phone call a couple months later, asking for a job reference, you know, you can't exactly. I mean, you are not allowed to say this person committed fraud,
right,
especially if they haven't been convicted. And it's a very sensitive subject. And a lot of times, the employer, even though they know that the employee is a bad actor, they're just limited with what they can say, and therefore the fraud ends up moving to a different employer and so on. So it is really a problem. And then, as I mentioned, the other thing is one of the statistics that is highlighted in this annual report by the ACFE is that most of the time the individuals that commit fraud are mid to senior level employees, and they're people who've been with a firm for 10 plus years. And what really ends up driving the individual to commit fraud is not that they have been committing fraud or committing crime their whole life. It's that there's a change in circumstances. They become addicted to drugs. They are going through a divorce. They have some sort of issue, maybe health related, that's causing financial distress. I mean, the reasons are numerous. Gambling problems. I mean, all of these issues are ones that we've seen in cases that we've handled. So a lot of times they are what I would call the relatively good people who go bad.
Right. Another reason why you keep up with your employees and what their activities are, mm-hmm. After you hire them.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about anti-money laundering. Easy for me to say. AML. So, yes. So anti-money laundering, I think, particularly a small business owner hears that and thinks, come on, this is a big bank, or this is a big company. This is not something, or maybe it's the local front for a drug dealer. I mean, this is not something that affects me.
Yes, and most of the work that I do in the anti-money laundering space is working with financial institutions. And a lot of the work that I do in the anti-money laundering space is specifically with community banks, who have really gotten a lot of pressure from their regulators recently around anti-money laundering. And the reasons are numerous. But just to provide a quick background on anti-money laundering and why financial institutions have an anti-money laundering issue, is that there are various regulations, federal regulations in place. There's also state regulations that require financial institutions to set up certain processes, procedures, and controls to help prevent, detect, and report suspected money laundering. And by money laundering, what that means is trying to clean or move around the money or proceeds that are related to over 200 different federal crimes. So it can be, I think when we all think of anti-money laundering, we think of, you know, terrorist group moving money, Mexican drug cartels smuggling funds. But we're also talking about elder financial exploitation. We're talking about embezzlements. We're talking about tax evasion, on and on and on. I believe there's 206 crimes. So with that background, financial institutions have to set up these policies, procedures, and controls and processes in place to monitor certain transactions, to monitor customers, and really determine, based on the type of transactional activity, whether something ain't right. And what we do is we go in and work with financial institutions to set up their anti-money laundering program, test their anti-money laundering program, help them run it from a day-to-day basis. And then where there are issues that are identified by regulators, help them remediate. But where community banks especially have been getting a lot of pressure, and this is recent, is that regulators had been hyper-focused on the mega banks over the last 10, 15 years.
Sure.
And we've all seen the headlines.
Right.
Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, HSBC, we're reading about Deutsche Bank, the
right.
list goes on and on. Because of that pressure from the regulators over the last 15 years, they have strengthened their controls. And because they've strengthened their controls, it makes it harder for the criminals to launder money. Because of that, the criminals are going to smaller and smaller financial institutions who don't have the money, the time, the resources, And really just the availability sometimes of good qualified trained staff, to run an effective program. So, the criminals are moving a lot of activity over to community banks, and accordingly, the regulators are putting a lot more pressure on community banks to strengthen their anti-money laundering programs. And one more thing I wanted to point out here with regard to community banks is that I mentioned that when we talk about anti-money laundering, a lot of times we do think of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the Mexican drug cartels.
Right.
But think about what's going on in the news these days. You've got an opioid crisis. You've got a meth crisis. You have white supremacists who are committing all sorts of bad acts. The Charlottesville protests, marches a couple years ago. And those are not individuals that bank with large banks. Those are smaller, small town pharmacies. They're small town doctors.
Right.
They're individuals who are more likely banking at community banks. And those are all major issues that community banks need to be able to have transparency about. Is my local farmer using their farming bank account to funnel the proceeds of meth? Think of the Walter White issue.
No,
Breaking Bad.
Right, right.
That happens.
Yeah.
Is the local car wash a front for cleaning the proceeds of drug funds? So these are all issues that that are at the forefront, especially in community banks and smaller regional banks, where they've got to kind of get it together and strengthen their controls to help prevent and detect this type of activity.
So you work with smaller banks or banks of all sizes, I'd imagine, but certainly community banks that are under this pressure and maybe don't have adequate AML safeguards. You really work with them to make sure that they've got the latest when it comes to the technology that's involved or the processes that are involved.
Exactly. We'll work with them to help make sure that they've got the tools in place and the right policies and procedures to help them understand who their customers are, what types of transactions are occurring, and whether that may be an indication of some sort of wrongdoing. And I did fail to mention that one of the biggest issues that certainly is facing community banks these days in the country is elder financial exploitation. It is huge. It's all over the news these days. It's a priority of the current administration. We're sitting here in Georgia. The Georgia legislature has made it a priority, but it's a priority all over the country, and because of the magnitude of the issue. While the estimates range and vary widely, it's estimated that elder financial exploitation is between a $3 and $35 billion problem a year. And there was a report that was put out a couple months ago, I believe it was back in February, that stated that 1 in 4 elder Americans is going to be the victim of elder financial exploitation.
Wow.
And if you think that's a wow,
yeah.
The average loss, $42,000.
Oh my.
Yes.
And that strikes me. You mentioned the embarrassment factor, not wanting to report it. That when it comes to fraud in a small business, strikes me that may be an issue with the elderly, that they get taken and they don't want to report it.
Yeah, absolutely. There certainly is a kind of an embarrassment or pride factor there.
Sure.
And then, of course, you have issues that are unique to elders. There has to be an assessment as to whether there's any cognitive decline, any sorts of other issues. And unfortunately, as hard as it is for us to kind of comprehend this, the statistics are really shocking about who commits elder financial exploitation. And unfortunately, in more than half the cases, it is a relative of the elder, a son, a daughter, a nephew. And that is, you know, that's
very disturbing.
Disappointing.
I mean,
it's one thing, not like it makes it any better, but I think it's not surprising to find out that there are individuals all over the world that are trying to scam a lot of our elders with sweepstakes scams and lottery scams and IRS scams. I mean, we've probably all gotten phone calls that most of us listen to and hang up right away and kind of chuckle and laugh.
Oh yeah.
But it's a completely different dynamic when you hear about elders who've had their son or daughter steal their entire life savings. And there is a direct tie. There's a great article in the Washington Post probably about 3 months ago about the connection between elder financial exploitation and the opioid crisis, because they're finding that in a lot of cases, both with relatives of elders and with strangers, that a lot of times these elders are being exploited for reasons where the underlying issue is the opioid epidemic.
Gotcha. So, Jesse, talk as we wrap it up here, talk a little bit about how you help folks in this area. I mean, what are the services that you provide?
Yeah, so with elder financial exploitation, there's really two things that we do. I mentioned that financial institutions have to have anti-money laundering controls, and there are a number of underlying crimes that those controls are designed to prevent and detect. Elder financial exploitation is one of them. And it's an issue that, at least in my experience, and a lot of the literature would support this, that financial institutions are not focused on nearly as much as they should. And the red flags that would tend to indicate that there is elder financial exploitation are different than a lot of the other types of patterns, trends, and red flags that we see in other types of crimes. And because of that, financial institutions really need to focus on training their employees to detect potential elder financial exploitation and generally elder abuse, and then set up the right processes and controls. And we help financial institutions with strengthening their controls around elder financial exploitation. The other area that we assist with is with kind of traditional investigations where there is a suspicion of elder financial exploitation or where it's known. We will help quantify the issue. We'll help gather the facts and really help get a case together for either law enforcement or for private litigation. And I will be, I have assisted with an elder financial exploitation case and also serve as an expert witness in certain elder financial related cases.
Unfortunately, Jesse, you have to do this work, right? But it's great work trying to help people, keep them from getting taken. So for those that would like more information and would like to be in touch with you, tell them how they can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, I'm a director with Stout. I'm based in the Atlanta office. Our office is in Midtown Atlanta. My email address is jmorton@stout.com. And fortunately, our firm has what I would consider to be a very good informative website. So if you go on stout.com, you can get more information about our firm and more information about me specifically. And my contact information is there.
That's great, Jesse. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks for your patience with my voice. I appreciate that.
I tried to talk more.
Yeah, well, you did a great job on that. And folks would rather hear you talk than me anyway. So thank you again. Folks, just a reminder that you can listen to this show, our live shows that we do on Tuesday, every Tuesday at 11:30. We also do special shows like this one at other times during the week. And if you miss any of our live shows, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, YouTube, Spotify, basically any of your favorite podcast apps. You can find us, just search for North Fulton Business Radio. And you can also go to our website, northfultonbusinessradio.com, and find us there. We've got, this is show number 171 or two, I believe. And so we've had a wide variety of guests over these last 3.5 years we've been doing this show. So you can check out our archive at northfultonbusinessradio.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, North Fulton BRX. So for my guest, Jesse Morton, I'm John Ray. Join me and hopefully a better voice of mine next time here on North Fulton Business Radio.
Renaissance Rewards Extra is the checking account that checks all the boxes. Roadside assistance? Check. Cell phone insurance? Check. More than 400,000 local shopping discounts? Check. Up to $25 per month in ATM refunds and a great rate? Check. All in an easy-to-use mobile app. To open an account or find out more about Renaissance Rewards Extra Checking, go to renaissancebank.com or visit us at any of our more than 190 locations throughout the South. Renaissance Bank. Understanding you. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.